We come to Deuteronomy chapter 24. This evening we come to this message, in defense of the needy. Now, we know that in many countries, laws are often abused by the rich and the powerful to oppress the poor and the weak. But when we come to God's law, it becomes clear that God's law is geared towards the protection of the poor and the weak. We have noted that Moses was expounding the Ten Commandments for the nation of Israel before they crossed over the River Jordan to the land of Canaan. So imagine in front of you is a map of Israel with the River Jordan running down the center. Then to your left would be the Mediterranean Sea. Then there would be the land of Canaan and then the River Jordan. And on the other side would be the plains of Moab. So Moses had led the Israelites in the wilderness wandering for 40 years, and at last they were at the plains of Moab about to cross over to the promised land. And Moses knew that he was going to die before the Israelites cross over. God had not allowed him to cross over. He could only climb up Mount Pisgah and there from the top of the mountain look across the promised land. Then he was going to die. And before he died, he wanted to prepare the nation of Israel for their life in the land of Canaan. So Moses was still seeing himself as a servant of God. He had still work to do, even in his old age. He had still work to do, even though he knew he would soon, very soon indeed, he would die. So that was his outlook. He served the Lord right to the end. His true rest would be in heaven. While on earth, he was going to serve the Lord right to the end. And that should be our attitude. Often we think of retirement, see? And we let ourselves forget all responsibilities and try to enjoy ourselves. But actually, retirement from one type of work requires that we engage in another type of work. So in our walk with God, unlike in the world, you see, where you drop everything and you think of having an easy time. No. But in God's work, it is a case of serving the Lord till the end. So we might not be able to do physical work anymore, but there are the lighter works which are nevertheless just as important, which must be done. So we must have the right attitude towards our service to God. Moses had such an attitude. He served God right to the end. So he was concerned for the welfare of the children of Israel. They were going to cross over. He himself was going to be with God. But he was concerned that those left behind should know God's law and apply the law of God correctly. And so he expounded the Ten Commandments for them. Now up to this point, we know that the commandments have been expounded quite clearly, verse by verse or commandment by commandment. In the early chapters, Moses expounded on those commandments that were contained in the so-called first table of the law. Remember, the Ten Commandments were written on two tables of the law, and the first table of the law, Bible scholars would regard the first four commandments as the first table of the law because they have to do with our relationship with God. Then commandment number 5 to number 10 have to do with our relationship with man. So the first four commandments has to do with only God alone to be worshipped, how and with what attitude of heart and on what day. Then commandment number 5 to number 10 concerns our relationship with men. So we honor our parents. Then after that are serious external crimes like murder, adultery. Then it becomes more and more towards the sins of the heart. Then the next 3 would be stealing, bearing false witness, and covetousness. So that's how you can remember the Ten Commandments. Okay. So often people have difficulty. After the fourth commandment, they have difficulty. We know fourth commandment has to do with the day, keeping the day of the Lord holy. So you finish already. When we come to commandment number 5, or honor your parents. See, then commandment number 6, then you have difficulty already. So most people stop after this five and then they're confused over the next few. So one way of remembering is that the next five have to do with external leading to internal. So murder, adultery, then stealing. So it gets deeper and deeper into the hearts. Huh? Then bearing false witness, then covetousness. Eh? So in that way you are able to remember the all 10 commandments. And in the previous two chapters, the commandment of adultery has been applied in various situations so that the nation knew how to handle other situations that are not covered. So big issues are dealt with so that smaller issues can also be handled by them when encountered later on. But after that, the next three commandments are not expounded in a clearly defined way, chapter by chapter, but instead, the last three commandments, namely stealing, bearing false witness, and covetousness, these three are, as it were, intermixed in the many examples given. So this is what we find. So from starting from chapter 24 onwards, we are going to find that commandment 8, 9, and 10 are applied to the nation of Israel, to various case studies. So again, take note that not all possible cases are covered, otherwise the Bible will have to be a big book. But examples are given of cases such that those in between or those lesser cases would be able to be handled by the nation of Israel themselves once they understood how the commandments were to be applied to the bigger cases. So all in all, what is the purpose of this chapter? The purpose of this chapter is to show to us that God's people must care for the weak and the poor in their midst. So we learn that God expects the poor and the weak to be protected. And we will see the New Testament equivalent as we go along. And we now look at how the application of the last three commandments apply to the various cases to bring home the point that the poor and the weak are to be protected. Now first, in verse 1 to verse 5, we have the marriage laws. Now why is marriage, the application of the commandments to marriage, regarded as the protection of the poor and the weak? Now you must understand that the nation of Israel was basically a patriarchal type of society. So the inheritance would be passed on to the sons, not the daughters. You remember in the days of Moses in the wilderness wandering, when they were dividing up the land, they have not entered the promised land yet, but Moses was given instructions already as to how they were to divide the land. So which tribe was to have what and how much and so on. Then there was the family where they had only daughters. So they came to Moses, so what about us? So we have only daughters. So Moses consulted with God, and the answer given was that the daughters in that case were to receive their inheritance just like they were sons. But otherwise, it was a patriarchal society, and the inheritance would go to the sons. So in that way, the daughters, as it were to find their security in marriage. And therefore, in a sense, it placed them in somewhat of a disadvantage. If they were married and everything was well, then they would be protected. But if they were married and they were exploited in a marriage, or if they were not married, and they would not be protected, you see, then they would be in difficulty. So remember that for everything good, there would be the possibility of abuse. For anything which is set as a norm, there will be exceptions. Okay? The norm means what is normal, what is normally expected, what should be the rule. Then we deal with the exceptions. So God's plan was that men should take the lead in society, in the family, in the church. Men should be the leaders. And men should protect the ladies. The wives are to be supporters of the work. They are equal in value before God. They are equally sinful. They need equally to be forgiven by God. They are saved in the same way through faith in Jesus Christ who was to come. See? But the point is that God has different roles for men and women. So in those days, wars were fought literally with fists and with weapons. You see, now you don't expect ladies to win because God created ladies for a different purpose. God created ladies to play the supportive roles, to take care of the home, to bear children. So their body structure is such that it operates in a certain way, and the hormones operate in a certain way. Each month they have the flow of blood and so on, causing them to behave slightly differently. You see, so they are different. So therefore, generally speaking, men are of bigger body structure. Their bones are bigger, their muscles are thicker. A few exceptional women can train themselves to have muscular bodies, but those are exceptions. So as a general rule, they put a man and a woman to slug it out, to fight it out. Of course, the woman will be at a disadvantage. And so as a general rule, you don't send the ladies out to fight in a war. The men are to protect the ladies. They have to fight the enemies. So generally, we must understand that God set that as a norm, that the men had to take the lead, they had to protect the family, the women were to play the supportive role, and to therefore understand that their role is different from that of men. Okay? So it is because we live in a sinful world that the idea of inferiority and superiority came in, and we began to compare and began to jeer at one another, who is stronger, who is better, who is more intelligent, and so on. See, in many qualities, women are better than most men. For example, in intelligence and in terms of resilience, you know, they might not have the strength of the solid brick, but they have the strength of the inner core of the metals, the steel bars. And so if men were to stand alone without the metal bars in there, if you use a sledgehammer and knock, the pillar will crack and fall. Men's type of strength, this is the brittle type of strength. They must have the metal inside to give it additional strength. So that's where the role of the women come in. So in many families, it's the wives who hold the family together. See, you look around, even up to today, you ask around, you discover many grow up in broken homes or homes that were never happy. And it's the wives, the mothers who held the family together. If not for the mothers quietly, you know, slogging on, you know, quietly taking care of the children growing up, you know, the husbands were such rascals. The husbands were so brittle. The husbands can be angry and shout and have a fist fight, but that is all that they are good at. They are unable to stand long. They don't have that resilience. You see? So that's why men needs the women, the women need the men. So that was the norm set by God. Yeah? Different roles to play, and together we complement one another. But there are exceptional situations. See, women was to find their security in marriage. But what if the marriage did not work out well? Then they will need to be protected. Okay? So with this in mind, we come to understand why these laws are given in this chapter. It falls under the category of the weak and the needy. Okay? So in a situation where a woman is married and then being exploited by the man, for example, the man married the woman knowing that that family was rich. So in that way, he got an inheritance, a share of the inheritance from the family. Then he uses up the inheritance. Then he divorces the wife. And we have noted that divorce, strictly speaking, was not allowed. But in the time of Moses, Moses have consulted with God, and although it's not recorded for us, the Lord Jesus Christ, when he was on earth, he said that Moses allowed them because of the hardness of man. So it was a law introduced temporarily because of the hardness of man. So men might find that the woman he married not quite what he expected. Don't misunderstand. That means men can just at his whims and fancy divorce a woman. No. See, what it meant was this. The man got married to the woman, and then he might find that the woman was not a virgin after all, like what we have learned in the previous two chapters. Then
if he is genuinely aggrieved, he is genuinely aggrieved, he honestly thought that he was marrying a virgin, but that wife turned out to be someone who was loose before marriage. She had been sleeping around with other men. If the husband had proved that was the case, then Moses allowed for such a situation for the man to divorce the wife. So if there's some uncleanness of some kind like that, for example, it normally has to do with sexual impurity other than adultery. We say other than adultery because if it was adultery, then the person will have been stoned to death. You see, on the previous in the previous chapters, this has been taught. See, so by impurity here is impurity of that kind, a kind different from adultery. So the woman might have been found to have been loose in her living before marriage, or the woman might have some unhygienic, filthy habit. See? So in the previous chapter, there is chapter 23, verse 14, concerning passing motion. The Israelites had to go out of the camp, verse 14. Yeah? And we are told there that they have to cover up, verse 12 to verse 13, they have to dig the ground and cover their feces. Yeah? And we are told in verse 14, for the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give your enemies over to you. Therefore your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. So the unclean thing in the original language is the same word that is used here for the wife who is found to be unclean. So it can be something unhygienic. For example, the wife has an unusual discharge. Instead of the monthly discharge of blood, it might be that it's not a once a month thing, it is every day perhaps, or it might be that she had an infection that could not be cured at that time, or she might have some dirty habits of having sexual relationship with animals, and that is condemned in the Bible as well. Okay? So things like that, of that nature, you know, the Lord said, don't allow such to be found in the midst of you. If there's any indication of uncleanness, then Moses had consulted with God and it was allowed at that time for the man to divorce the wife. But procedures must be followed. First, there must be a certificate of divorce. So if the certificate clearly states for what reason, and then is handed over to the wife, and the men have a ceremony of bringing the wife out of the house so that everybody knows that it was for some uncleanness and not because the wife had committed adultery. See? So in that case, the wife, when she's divorced, she might possibly get married again. See? And if the husband, the second husband, were to divorce her in the same way as the first husband, she should not run back to the first husband. Or if the second husband were to die, she should not come back to the first husband. She might possibly marry another person, the third man, say, as her husband, but she could not go back to the same husband. Now this was to prevent frivolous way of divorcing and simply treating marriage as something so light. See? So you see now that people manufacture excuses for divorce, temporary divorce, to gain whatever. Perhaps you see this man, he said to his wife, let us divorce for perhaps 1 year, then I'm going to marry that other woman who is rich. Then after that, I'm going to divorce her, I come back to you, okay? You see, that type of thinking might happen, you see. So abuse of the system could easily happen. You see that even today that happens. We hear, for example, of people in certain countries, they want to migrate to America. So they make arrangements with their wives that they would temporarily divorce. Then they would go there and then get the green card and then later get the wife over and then get married there. Or what they say. So we come across people abusing the system like that. So when we understand the perversity of the human mind, and we understand the situation at that time, how the possibility of divorce was allowed, we come to realize that what was allowed could easily be abused. People could easily just temporarily divorce their wife and then have them back. So God wouldn't want that sort of thing to happen. So there was a clear law against this, that wife you divorce, you really want to divorce her? Is that for a good reason? Have you followed procedure? Then once divorce is divorced, don't take her back. So that was to prevent such abuse. Otherwise, the man might make arrangement with the wife to temporarily divorce and then have her back again. See, then that was not right. So divorce is divorce. It's, you don't take her back anymore. So in that way, although divorce was never approved by God, it was allowed only because of the hardness of the hearts of people at that time. But nevertheless, it could easily be abused. So in order to prevent such abuse, that was written down. Then we note that all this while, verse 1 to verse 4, we have been looking at the marriage laws and divorce in a negative way. What should not be allowed, you see? But now in verse 5, more positively, marriage was to be something that is looked upon with as a blessing from God. And God desires the couple to be happy. And the young man who is newly married was not to be made to take part in war in case he got killed. So in the first year of his marriage, he was discharged from the army. He was allowed to go home. We have come across this already in chapter 20, verse 7. But here, that law was expanded further. Any other tasks that involve that is of the form of some national service, see? Any task that is required by the community, that man who is newly married was to be spared from that duty. Let him, you know, that is busy enough trying to build up his family. And remember also another thing, that in those days, most marriages were arranged marriages. So the husband and wife would not know one another well before marriage. So it could be just a few days before marriage before they met. So, or it could be from a distance that they knew, or somebody's daughter of that family, see, but they have not been able to freely interact with one another. Then after the two families arrange for the marriage, then they have to begin to get to know one another. So the period of adjustment, the period of discussing how many children they wanted, the period of discussing the way they were to raise up their children, issues like that. The husband was to be spared national service of any kind, such that he could spend time with the wife, and together they built up their new family. Okay? And Psalm 127 shows to us that God looks upon children as a blessing, yeah, from him. So we must look upon it that way, and especially in an agricultural community, the more children, the more blessed the family would be. And even today, people like to have as few children as possible. Yeah? We say that is not biblical thinking. We would say that you should have as many children as you can. Say, but how many is that many? Say, then that is up to you to determine. And for myself, I would say 3 is a nice number. 4 would be very good. 5 is best. 2 is too few. 1 is definitely not enough. Okay, so Psalm 127 says in verse 3, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with the enemies in the gate." So to be happy and blessed is to have a quiver full of children, full of arrows. So a quiver, how big is a quiver? I would say, how many arrows can you fit in? Certainly not two. Certainly not three. The quiver full, you see, I would say minimum five. The truly blessed man. Yeah. So even in today's world, we must not become unbiblical in thinking and say that, you know, I want just one child. If God can give you more, why don't you have more? Okay. But how many is enough? It's up to you to determine. So husband and wife must prayerfully blend this together. And that's why there's such a thing as marriage counseling. We talk about husband-wife relationship, we talk also about your children. And you don't wait till children arrive, then you begin to think of the principles of training them. And you see, for example, you don't work out whether you husband and wife don't have a disagreement, whether corporal punishment is right or whether caning is right or wrong. Okay. Then perhaps one monkey cane and the other invite the monkey cane, and then the two quarrel in front of the child. Then that is not going to be good. Then the child grows up knowing that he can play psychology with a father and mother and put a wedge between them, and that's not good. So basic principle is that the husband and wife must stand on the same principle. So that is the first relationship. Then the parent-child relationship is the second relationship in the family. That type of principles have to be worked out in advance. And if you don't read about it, you don't ask, you don't study about the biblical principles in advance. You wait till children come, then kalangkabut, you're panicky. You know, what do we do in such a situation? And then what about the practical things like, you know, how feeding the children? Breastfeeding good? Nowadays people say breastfeeding is good. So but for how long? Some families have breastfeeding for children beyond 2 years old, they're still breastfeeding. Ridiculous, we say. So you overdo things. Then there are babies with problems, and they have rashes when they fit with cow's milk. So therefore, what do we do? Say, and the mother that has no breast milk, so you panic, you don't know what to do. Say, now things of this nature have to be sorted out. If you ask the older parents and those who have more experience and those who have a little bit of medical knowledge, they would be able to guide you so much. You say, if cow's milk, the milk powder made from cow's milk is not suitable, there's goat's milk. And why didn't you you use that? And if you consulted the right doctors, they would be able to advise you on these things as well. But what I'm trying to say is there are a number of basic things that should have been sorted out long before the children came. See, why didn't you think along that line? So because you're just thinking of building up your career, all these things are more important to you. Family is not important. That's why. But if family is important and children is a blessing, then you would think along that line. You would draw near to those godly parents and observe and ask questions and why they did certain things in certain ways, why they disciplined their children in certain ways. You see, why they wouldn't allow the grandma to intervene to play the good guy. You say, come here, grandma loves you. You see, and then pit the grandma and the parents in front of the children. You see, we don't allow for that. We tell the grandma nicely, say, please don't intervene when we discipline our children. See, otherwise the child begin to play up and divide the parents as bad guys and grandma as good guys. You see, things like that. You see, if it's not explained, then the grandma will feel so slighted. You know, my grandchildren, or why can't we show our love to the grandchild? So if not explained, then tension develops. You see, so you see now I throw out some examples that causes you to realize, you see, this sort of things could have been sorted out long ago. Why didn't I? You thought, you know, because there was those days, nobody guided you. And the younger ones now, you benefit. If you haven't attended tonight's Bible study, you would have missed this. It might be mentioned some other place, some other time, but you might not be there as well. But at least because you came tonight, God blesses you with this knowledge. Now you begin to take note, you begin to pursue, be prepared. You say, God desires to bless His people. And this is what we learn from this passage tonight, that there are ramifications to the Word of God. We study, this is what it teaches and how it's applied, and then there are these implications to us. So now we come to the second section, the legal system, verse 6 to verse 18. There are those who needed to take a loan. They had to borrow from people. And not, by the way, our Asians and especially Malaysians use the word borrow and lend very wrongly. I borrow from you, you lend to me. You don't borrow to me. See? So we don't see the difference, you see. So if I borrow something from you, then you have lent me something. Don't say you borrow me something. Okay? So that is again something on the side that you benefit by coming to the meeting here tonight, you see. Through this message, we learn many things aside from the main things here, you see. So in those days, the poor borrowed money to feed the families when their crops had failed, see. And the lender, not the borrower, see. The borrower is the one who needs. The lender is the one who loans out the things, yeah. And we have learned already in chapter 23, verse 19, that in Israel, they don't charge interest in cases like this. And of course, it could be abused. People can pretend and cry a sob story and try to get money from you thinking that you are rich. You say, so my children going to university, I know we're having difficulty. So in the hope that you will loan them money, you say, take advantage of situation. Yeah? But when the law was given in the nation of Israel, it was intended for those who are really poor, who are needy, who would not have borrowed, but simply because situation was such, perhaps the crop failed in that particular season and their children are hungry. Then they have to borrow. Generally, we are dealing with people who are honest, who have dignity. They wouldn't want to borrow if given a choice. But because circumstances were such, they had no choice, they had to borrow. In which case, if you are in a position to loan to them the money or loan to them a sack of rice or whatever, then you must not charge interest. See? And the person should repay as soon as he's able. Yeah? And having said that, not charging interest is one thing. Holding something as pledge is another. So it was allowed for the lender to hold something from the borrower. Okay? As a pledge. So for example, say I have this necklace, you see, in a situation like this, you know, it's no point selling this. I don't want to sell this, but can I put this as a pledge first? You keep this for me when I come and return to you what I borrowed, then I take back what I have pledged to you. Huh? And the law was that you don't take as a pledge certain things. For example, the millstone, whether the upper millstone or lower millstone. And this sounds strange to us in our culture. But you must understand, being an agricultural society and being in those days, things were not so specialized yet. You have to cultivate your paddy, your wheat, whatever you collect them, your maize. Then you grind them yourself, you see, and then you dry. And then after that, you have to turn it into powder. How do you turn it into powder? And in many cultures, they use not the electric grinder that we have, not the big mills that we have, but it's a stone. One bigger one and one smaller one that's on top, and they're very heavy. You generally make from granite. And if you haven't seen one, you might want to check it out. It is just a round stone. So generally, let's say, depending on the size, the size that we use to. We have seen and we have used would be roughly about this size and this round, and the thickness would be about this, with a groove all around. Then what happened is generally a metal bar is drilled and then a metal bar is put inside there in the center, So there's this round stone with a groove around, see, and leading to a drain. So with a metal bar in the center here, short metal bar sticking there. And then there is a smaller piece. Okay? Then with a, at the side there, there is a rectangular hole cut where a piece of wooden handle is poked. See? Then what happened is, on the wooden handle would be another piece where you turn the upper stone, the main stone. See? Then there is a hole at the side there. Now the hole is a smaller piece, right? With a hole at the side. See? And so with the hole underneath here, it fits into the metal piece. Then it can be turned. So the upper and the lower one grinds against one another. There are some grooves on the lower stone. So in this upper stone, there is a side hole, right, that goes all the way down. If you pour your rice with some water in, okay, it flows down. And as you turn this upper piece, see, the rice gets ground between the two pieces. And then as the water is poured in, it drains to the side, the ridge of the lower piece, and drains down to a bucket. See? So that is how we turn the rice into powder, and it will be mixed with water like that. See? So generally, there is a handlebar with ropes tied from the ceiling, and it's attached to this side handle of the upper mill, okay, upper millstone. So what you do is, you see, you push a little bit, somebody push for you, so that once the handle is at an angle, you push, then you turn, you push, you turn, and you have to have a certain momentum. Kung Fu is involved all the time, everything. But if you pull, and then you stop, you get stuck. See? Then somebody has to come and push it for you, then you again do it. So another person will just stand by a bucket of water with rice and water, rice in the water. He'll scoop with some rice and some water and pour into the hole in the top millstone, and it gets ground like that. So as it's grounded, it will flow down into the bucket below. See? Then the bigger ones, of course, will have those bigger millstones. Will have a cow, you know, walking around in a circle, turning. So generally, in a home, is the type where the person turns by hand with a rope hanging to the handle like that. See? Now, the person is so poor, he has nothing to give as a pledge. So you take the upper millstone. No. That means you lend him some rice or some food. He comes home, he wants to grind his rice. He couldn't. The family will go hungry. So don't take the lower millstone or don't take the upper millstone. The two must be intact. Take that. And don't take the outer coat, because at night they rely on that to keep warm. See? So if you take that as a pledge, see, by evening you must return. And every day you go and take, and then evening you have to go and return. Soon you say, I don't want to take that as a pledge. It is to discourage you from taking the coat as a pledge. And for widows, you don't take it from her at all. See? Whether for one day only and return at night, you don't do that. Verse 17, the second part of verse 17 tells us, for widows who are generally with no husband and no children at home and they are old, they really need that coat badly even during the day. So you don't ever take the coat as a pledge. So all in all, you discover that these laws were intended to protect those who were poor and who were weak. See? Then we come to verse 7, kidnapping. Kidnapping was serious because human life is sacred and humans are made with God's image. All of us have dignity. So some may be rich, some may be poor, some may have high positions in society, some may have lower position. We give honor to those who require to be honored. So we give honor where it is due. But there is basic human dignity. Humans are different from animals. You don't ever treat a human like an animal. And in those days, the Israelites were not allowed to kidnap. You cannot take a person and sell him off to the foreigners. The foreigners who badly treat them. See? But because human minds are so perverse, they want to earn extra money. And they see at this next village, you know, we are not related. They just kidnap. If same in the same village, we are, everybody knows everybody and you are related, then you might not have the heart to do so. But some don't have the heart. They are cruel. They are prepared to kidnap and sell off the people they are kidnapped. Then up to today, in the name of laborers, providing laborers. You see, basically people are doing that. See, people are still being sold off, as it were. They might not use that term, but it's basically the same. Have we not heard up to now, you know, even in our part of the world, there is such a thing as human trafficking. Huh? See? And it's not just one person each time, it can be a group of persons. So the people might want to find a better living elsewhere in another country, but there are those who exploit this situation. So they don't tell the truth. They say, oh, you earn this much, but when you arrive, you don't earn that much. And you're not there as a worker, you're a virtual slave. So your passport is withheld, then you're made to work long hours, and labor laws strictly require one day in a week of rest, but they are not allowed to rest, and it is claimed that they are given overtime, but they are really made to work, and some worse than others. We have actually come across cases where there were virtual slaves. Remember, there was a time when we had to drive all the way to Johor Bahru, look at some of our friends from Sri Lanka. The condition was such that the employer cut their pay, and they were left with nothing much more. So if they had known, they wouldn't have come. Okay. But they promised one thing, they found the situation not quite what it was. So things like that can still happen even today. So direct kidnapping of individuals where you have bundled away against your wish that has happened, and tricking people into working under conditions worse than the economy that happens. So here is a case of a kidnapper who possibly take the person and sell him off to foreigners where they are abused. Labor, or they are not treated as truly human. So they would be put to death. The Lord would not allow such thing as kidnapping to occur in people. Then there is quarantine of infectious diseases, verse 8, verse 9. The more detailed treatment of diseases is given in Leviticus chapter 13. 14, where the priests are taught to recognize that it's given category of skin diseases, and if there is any sign that is infectious, the person will be kept under observation, under quarantine, and observed, and then after every few days they will be examined, and if the person is getting better, the person might be allowed to come back home, otherwise the person will be under quarantine. But here, the people were just reminded. The details of how the priests were to determine whether the disease is infectious or not is not handled, but Moses just reminded the people that such laws have been given already. And of course we know it is found in our Bible in Leviticus 13-14. But the people were taught that if such a thing were to happen, they were to comply with the law of the nation. Don't act by yourself thinking that, no, it's my child who is sick. What business has that got to do with the community? No, you cannot argue like that anymore. You must think that if the child is having an infectious disease, it's not going to affect only the family, it's going to affect the whole community. And once the disease spreads, it is going to be very difficult to contain. Okay? And the people were reminded. Remember Miriam? Miriam, the sister of Moses, she was stricken with leprosy, and it was so frightening to the people at that time. She was stricken with leprosy as a judgment upon her for going against her own brother, challenging his authority. Yeah? And Moses had to pray for him, then God healed her. And when Moses prayed for her and she was healed. But the point is, the people all remember, it's recorded in their history. So in our Bible it is recorded that Miriam was struck with leprosy. So that shook the people. So you know, it is that there are various categories of diseases that are covered under this law. But the point is that the case of Miriam is mentioned to just joke the people, to say, you don't want such a situation to happen, do you? That a person stricken with real bad leprosy and it spreads, you don't want that to happen. Today we know that other skin diseases are not called leprosy, they are called by different names. But the leprosy that was most feared at that time, today we call it the Hansen disease. But it's generally still known as leprosy. So in the Bible, leprosy covers all categories, including what we call Hansen's disease today. It covers more than that. There are other diseases that are just as bad. And similarly, there are infectious things that might not be good for health. For example, you hang up your clothes, and then the weather has been damp, and the clothes haven't dried up. And then one day you notice, why my clothes are like black patches, greenish patches are spreading. You know that mildew of some kind is infectious, it spreads, and it carries pores that when spread in the air. Today we understand it this way, that the pores in the air will be breathed in and we would have health problems of various kinds. And similarly, there are wooden and mud houses. See, if it's damp, then the wood will have those molds growing and then it can spread. And soon the house may be rotten and the whole thing fall down. And with the dampness, those molds are spreading also, the pores can be in the air. And again, when you breathe in, it is not healthy. Okay? Now, this is with the advantage of hindsight, with the advantage of science today. Okay? But in those days, God gave them this law in order to protect his people from such diseases and such harm to their health. Okay? Then in verse 14 to verse 15, there is the payment of wages. Now, casual laborers earn their living day by day. Who are these casual laborers? We thought that the nation of Israel had inheritance. Each tribe had land, and the land would be subdivided to the clans, and the clans to the family. So each family would have land. So there should be sufficient. Why should there be people who earn wages in a daily way? But you must understand, there would be those who were foreigners settled in the nation of Israel. When they settled and they were absorbed as part of the nation, they worshipped the God of Israel, they were to be treated kindly. And such people, they did not have inheritance, but they were welcome as the people of Israel since they worshipped their God. And the Israelites were told to treat such foreigners kindly. Then there would be people from the remote places who wanted to come to the cities to work. Yeah? And in any society, there's constant movement of people like this. And again, we see it even up to today. See? For the individual, we are just thinking of studying, having a degree, then finding a job. But for city planners and for statesmen, for politicians, see, they have to have a global view of things, a bird's eye view of things. They have to look at the nation. What is the population like? See, how many percent are young people, how many percent are middle age, how many are old? And then they have to think also the workforce. See, what is our country producing? Is it just agriculture, or do we depend only on mining, or do we have manufacturing? Then they have to plan. See, then they have to plan for the housing. See, now if we have manufacturing, then we need workers. Where would the workers come from? Oh, they would come from the rural areas because there would be not enough workers in the cities. So when they come, therefore, we have to build flats, sufficient housing. Otherwise, there will be slum. They will find jobs, and then they will create their own little huts, and then soon a slum area will form. See, all these are those who deal with planning for the in a global way. And the individual who is so self-centered, who is so protected all this while, he's just thinking, study, get a degree, earn a job, find a good job, settle down. And there's no reason for you to think globally, think as a nation, as a whole, to have all this planning. You see? But others have to do it. Now, Moses had to do it. The nation, the leaders have to do it. They have to plan like that. Then there would be those who move from the rural area to the urban area, the cities, in order to earn a living. There's always constant movement of people. Even up to today, it is happening. That's why outreach has to be done in a global way as well. Don't just think of individuals, you know. When we see them, we just preach the gospel. When we see them, preach the gospel. No, church leaders have to see things and plan things, you know. The nation as a whole, the state, you know, the city, where the area where we live in. What sort of people are here? Then we have to plan the people to bring the gospel to the different people groups. So whether you are a leader is dependent on this ability to see things in global ways, to know what to do in a situation like that. So that's why in the church, it's not just technical skill. Oh, you are good at something, and you know, therefore, you know, since you are high up in the your profession, therefore you should have a position of leadership in the church. He said, no. Spiritual leaders have to look at things God's way. Okay? And being a leader, it means that you are no more a follower. Others are followers. People say there are only leaders and there are followers. That's one good way of looking at things. Really, it is like that. So who do we appoint in leadership position in the church? Does he have this quality? Being able to see things globally, to see what is really the solution for the given situation. So here we see that there are migrant workers. Where are they from? Bangladesh, Myanmar, Nepal, Indonesia. And see where they are assigned to. Indonesians are generally in the construction sector. Myanmar people are mostly in the service sector, working in restaurants, coffee shops. Nepali workers are mainly in the security sector. Things like that. You look and you can see a pattern. You take note. Others don't have reason to want to take note. But because you are a church leader, you have to take note. Then the gospel has to go to them in a certain way. And these are people who work from what time to what time, and then they are off. So these people are they work from particular the nature of their work is such that you can reach them only at certain times, certain places. So all in all, we see this constantly happening, and here is the teaching on what to do in a situation like this. People come, they earn a daily living, and for you, you are not earning a daily living. You work, your salary comes month by month, you don't realize. You work hand to mouth. Today's earning, tomorrow they are, and the wife is going to the market to buy something for the children. So today, if the wages not paid, to you, you are the boss. To you, you employ these people. Withhold their wages. Next week, then I pay. To you, it's a small matter, but to the worker, it's such an important matter. And you don't realize this person is, you know, he's so anxious, so worried. He's thinking of his wife, his children at home. And today you don't give him his wage. Tomorrow his children are going to go hungry. So to protect such, the law is given. You must give the wages in due time. Okay? Don't just think from your point of view. You must think of how it affects the laborers like that. And the people were reminded to have a heart of compassion for those who are weak and needy like that. They were reminded that in their earlier years, they were in Egypt, and there they were sojourners, and there they were not always treated well, see, and you don't want to do the same towards others, see. So you have been mistreated before, at least your ancestors have been mistreated, you know full well, that's why now this teaching is given. So you on your part, don't be like that, don't do it back to others, think of how it will affect other people. So don't oppress others, don't hold back their wages, don't cause difficulties to them. Have a heart of compassion. Then we come to personal responsibility for criminal offenses, verse 16. Now, you must distinguish here crime worthy of death and the effect of crime. Yeah. And when transferred to New Testament teaching, you must distinguish between sin and salvation, the effects of sin and salvation. So here is a young man. He commits a crime. He goes and steals somebody's goat and he brings home. The father of the house cannot say, it's he who steals, it's not me. So you ignore it. No, he's your son. You must rebuke him, you must get him to return the goat. See? So this law must not be misunderstood as though the father don't bother. No, it is a case of who is to be punished if caught. So since the son is the one who stole, then the son has to be punished accordingly. Yeah. And especially crime that constitute capital offenses that require the death sentence. If the son has murdered somebody, for example, the father don't have to die for the son. The son has to bear the punishment and die. Yeah. But the effect is that the father will be sad, mother will be sad, the brothers and sisters will be sad, saddened. Then the family will be deprived of one son, and one son to work in the fields, that will be one person less, and so on. So a sin that requires the punishment, the person bears that punishment, but it has its consequences on the rest of the family. Okay? So when applied to salvation, by the time the prophet Ezekiel wrote, he shows to us that each person must be responsible for his sin. But that does not mean that you can sin as you like without thinking of the effect on others. No. Sin has its effect even when you are forgiven by God by faith in Jesus Christ. You might have to bear the consequences. And the consequences of sin can affect more person than just yourself. See? For example, a husband, see, he commits adultery, see. Then he contracts a disease. He passes it on to the wife, see. So the wife is affected, see. Who knows, the wife gives birth to a child, and that disease is passed on to that child in some way, see. So others are affected by the consequences of the sin. So we are not here talking about the consequences of the sin. God can actually punish a person for generations to come. So there are the consequences of the sin. But when we talk about salvation, the person standing before God, each person can be forgiven by God if each person repents and trusts in Jesus Christ for salvation. Okay? It doesn't mean that your father sinned, okay, then you can't go to heaven. No, you repent of your own sin and trust in Christ for salvation. And if the father repents, of course the father will be saved as well. The father cannot save himself and save his son. No, each person must find salvation for himself, and the sin we commit can have effects on others as well. But the responsibility of the sin lies with the individual. Okay? So we move on. The summary of it all, verse 17 and verse 18. We say this is a summary because the general principle of this chapter so far is spelled out. In verse 17, we are told, "You shall not pervert justice due to the stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment as a pledge." Basically saying, don't do wrong to those who are poor and needy. See? "But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore I command you to do this thing." Then we move on to the ownership of land. Each family in Israel had their own land. They could farm, they could plant, they have a ready harvest of grain, of olive, or of grapevine. So grapevine, you have fruit to eat, you have juice to drink, you have wine, you can do many things. You can cook with delicious meals out of all this. But what about the poor and the needy? See? This is where we again must think of them. Just because you are well doesn't mean everybody is well, you see. So have a thought for others. So every time the season comes, you go and cut your grain or you pick the grain in. Oh, so happy, isn't it? Today, good producer. Bumper harvest, just like this present durian season. Bumper harvest. We're so happy, you see. Hey, but I forgot. See, I thought I heard a durian drop somewhere. I think I better go back and search for that piece of durian. No, like you have bumper harvest already. You have baskets of them. That durian you heard dropped earlier, that one, leave it. Let the poor pick it up. That would be our equivalent today. So you are harvesting your wheat or your paddy. Then you thought that corner there, you know, sticking up. For some reason, we didn't harvest just now. When you remember it, you don't go back there and go and harvest those. No. You already have harvested the field already. Finished. Let the few standing here and there be the food of the poor and the travelers, the foreigners who do not have land of their own. They can come and glean from there after that. Similarly, when you beat the branches of the olive tree so that olives drop, you say, shake, 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 or use a, you know, use a pole, jolo, shake it so that olives drop. Then after collecting already from a distance, there, one bundle there, I missed that. He said, tomorrow I go back. The Lord said, don't. You already harvested the tree already. There will be a few here and there. Let the strangers and the poor and the needy go and collect. Similarly with your grapes. See, when you harvested, when you have harvested, you consider that as done. Let the leftovers be the food of the poor and the strangers who come your way. And again, the nation was reminded of the principle involved. Don't just think of yourself. Think of those who are needy, those who are poor. See, things might be all right with you, but it is not all right with others. Tonight you sit down, oh, the family is so happy because we are eating this nice dinner together. See? But remember that, you know, you are every day eating like this, but there are some families who don't have such a good meal to eat. It's not wrong for you to enjoy your harvest. It's not wrong for you to enjoy the fruit of your labor. By all means, have a clear conscience, eat well, but just spare a thought for those who are poor. So don't allow that thought to spoil your enjoyment of your meal. The Lord doesn't intend that to happen. You can rightly enjoy the fruit of your labor, but just that along the way, now don't be greedy and clean up everything from your field, and don't along the way forget that there are others who are needy, and then when you are in a position to help, you should help them. So in this verse 19, the second part, you know, we read the whole of verse 19. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So there is the promise that the Lord your God will bless you if you spare a thought for the poor and the needy. And then in verse 22, remember another thing which has been mentioned earlier in the chapter. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, therefore I command you to do this thing. So this is constantly reminded of the nation of Israel. Remember your ancestors, they were oppressed in Egypt. So don't oppress others, see. Instead, have a heart of compassion for others. Okay? So not oppressing others is one thing, but having a heart of compassion to definitely help, that is the extra step that we must take. And that is the teaching of the Bible. So as we draw to a close, we want to note the two main applications. First, good works was an integral part of the Lord's ministry. If you look at Matthew chapter 4, verse 23, and chapter 9, verse 35, when the Lord started his ministry, he announced that this was his vision and mission. His mission and vision. He will do three things. He would teach in the synagogue, preach the gospel of the kingdom, and he would do good works. And he continued until the peak of his ministry in chapter 9, Matthew chapter 9, verse 35. See, when thousands of people were following him, he still did those three things. He taught in the synagogue, he preached the gospel of the kingdom as he traveled about to win souls. Then he did good works, healing the blind and the lame and so on. Okay? Then you look at the Apostle Paul. Look at Acts chapter 20. He imitated the Lord in ministry. In verse 20 and verse 21, he tells us he preached repentance towards God and faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. So in other words, he preached the gospel. True? Acts 20. Then in verse 27, he delivered the whole counsel of God to those who were believers. That means he taught the word to believers. Then you look at verse 35. The Apostle Paul, on and off he earned money. You think he needed money for himself. Actually, he gave it to the poor. Okay? He was, no doubt some of it will be used for supporting himself, but rightly speaking, the churches he planted were supporting him. He relied on the churches to support him because the laborer is worthy of his wages, you see. But why did he do extra work of tent making? You thought it was tent making to support himself, but we are told specifically in Acts 20 verse 35, it was to give to the poor. See? So quietly, the Apostle Paul, who is known for teaching the word and defending the truth, quietly he was doing good works. He kept to the Lord's command in Matthew chapter 6, verse 3. What your right hand does, the left hand doesn't need to know. See? So that is why, up to today, the church should do that. We teach those who are believers already, build them up in the faith. But we also send people out and we preach the gospel to win souls. See? And plant churches. Then we quietly don't declare to the world, don't advertise, don't show off how much good works we have been doing. But quietly do plenty of good works. Together, in conjunction with teaching and preaching the gospel. See, that is the principle that we try to follow. Okay? And now you understand why we operate in certain ways. We don't swing to just teach just believers. We don't swing just to preach the gospel and plant churches. We do both. But we don't just concentrate on social work. We don't do that. See? We preach, we teach, see? But quietly we do plenty of good works. Okay? And we do plenty of it, but we don't declare it. See? And you see, when we are faithful in little, in all these three areas, we are faithful in much. See, God just opened up opportunities. See? And that's why people who have eyes to see, they say, oh, your church is so small, but you're doing so much. Our church is so much bigger, but we are doing so little. And they don't know how to start. They don't know how to do missions. How don't know how to be involved. And they have money they want to give to the poor. But where? How? See, they don't know. See? But actually, with guidance from the Bible, you discover that's how we continue in ministry in all these three areas. So all in all, on a personal level, we must be convinced of what the Apostle Paul teaches. See, the church is made up of individuals. Individuals must be convinced. When converted, you must have a heart for other people. Don't just think of doctrine only. Doctrine is important. In our church, we emphasize a lot of doctrine. See, correct doctrine is important. But outreach is also important. And doing good works, having a heart for others is also important. And so if you look at some of those passages, you look at Titus chapter 3. Titus chapter 3, verse 8. Good works is expected of the individual Christian. And you say, oh, good works there mean attending church, praising God, praying. That's good works. No. Verse 14, Titus chapter 3, verse 14 shows to us good works there means helping those who are poor and the needy. Okay? Then Galatians 6, verse 10 tells us to do good to all, especially to the household of faith. If possible, we want to do good to all, the Hindus, the Muslims, everybody, the Buddhists and so on, the pagans, the atheists. See? But we begin with the household of faith, because those are most closely related to us, and we often know that there are genuine needs there. So we extend help there first. See? And finally, note that the Apostle Paul based his teaching concerning generous giving on the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. He who is rich became poor for our sake. See? So it's talking about our salvation. So since the Lord who is rich became poor for our sake, see? So that we will be rich in the grace of God, we in turn must show it in our lives. Okay? So by faith in Jesus Christ, we are transformed to be a certain type of person. And that type of person exercises ministry in these three areas. Okay? So may God help us to be the people we ought to be. So are there questions or comments?